From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and so far, nobody has resigned from Congress today. A change after several resignations this week. Late yesterday, House Republican Trent Franks announced his resignation following Representative John Conyers, a Democrat of Michigan, on Tuesday, and Democratic Senator Al Franken yesterday. Joining us now is NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. Hi, Sue.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's start with Trent Franks. He's been in the House for a long time. He's one of the most socially conservative members. And he said yesterday he was resigning because of discussions he had about surrogacy with female staffers. What more do we know?
We know that Speaker Paul Ryan played a fairly pivotal role in his resignation. The Speaker's office said about approximately 2 weeks ago, it was brought to the attention of the Speaker's general counsel, some of these allegations, and that the counsel privately spoke to one of the female aides in question, deemed her allegations credible, and brought the matter to the Speaker, who then last week met privately with Trent Franks and told him that he would personally refer the matter to the Ethics Committee and recommended he resign. To the substance of the allegations, what we know for certain is that in a statement, Franks acknowledged that he had raised the issue of surrogacy with two female aides and acknowledged that the conversations had made them uncomfortable. He and his wife have struggled with infertility for years. The larger extent of the allegations, we simply don't know, but we do know that it was enough for the Speaker of the House to tell him to leave Congress.
And there are questions about whether it is really more than what's come out publicly that caused him to make this decision.
There is, and like I said, for the Speaker of the House to have risen to the level that the Speaker needed to personally get involved, personally say he would take it to ethics, and to tell a member of his own party to get out, clearly they were serious and substantive allegations.
And what about Al Franken, who, as we know, announced he was resigning yesterday? There's been some criticism of Democrats for forcing him out. Here's the former House Speaker, Republican Newt Gingrich, speaking on Fox News.
What you saw today was a lynch mob. Look, let's not have due process. Let's not ask anybody any questions. Let's not have any chance to have a hearing. Let's just lynch him. Because when we get done lynching him, we'll be so pure. We'll feel so good. This is a party which is losing its mind.
So that's a Republican. But on the other side, the progressive journalist Jonathan Alter tweeted, Democrats will rue the day they demanded Al Franken resign. They've given into the conflation of crimes and power abuse with boorishness. It won't get more women voters, and it will lose more anti-PC men suckers game. Is there regret on Capitol Hill?
No, not to the extent that I can tell, and not from Senate Democrats. Remember, at least 31 of Al Franken's colleagues came out ahead of his resignation, including Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, and said that they believe the allegations were enough for him to go. There's probably an element to this that they felt safer saying that because Minnesota has a Democratic governor and the next person that will fill that seat will be a Democrat. So there was probably a political calculation, of course, there. We are just experiencing, I think, a cultural and national moment that's even bigger than our politics, although obviously our politics are trying to capture it. And the fact that all of this is playing out ahead of this Alabama special election that's coming up next week, in which allegations of sexual assault and sexual misbehavior have become a center point of that cut race as well. I do think there has been a motivating force for Democrats to say that they want to be able to draw a contrast and say that there's a difference between the two parties here. And if you want to say there's going to be zero tolerance, you have to have zero tolerance. And that includes Al Franken, who I do think a lot of people who supported him and still support him don't think that the allegations against him rose to the level of the allegations against some other candidates and lawmakers. But they just said enough was enough.
Well, and what about Blake Farenthold, the Republican representative who used taxpayer money to settle an $84,000 sexual harassment claim? Yesterday, Republican Congresswoman Mia Love told CNN he should step down.
I think that he should voluntarily resign because I believe we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard. And where he may not feel like his behavior was inappropriate, obviously somebody did. Obviously, people felt uncomfortable.
What might happen here?
She is the second House Republican to call for him to resign. The first was Barbara Comstock, who's been a leading voice on this. She's a Republican from Virginia. The Ethics Committee on Friday also announced that they were reopening an inquiry into Blake Farenthold and how this played out and that settlement. He has personally said he will pay back the $84,000 to the Treasury out of his own pocket. it's a question mark, you know, that he presents a challenge for Republicans. I do think the speaker, as he demonstrated with Trent Franks, is also trying to send a message that this won't be tolerated on his watch. And the congressman from Texas has certainly denied any wrongdoing. But again, this isn't a court of law, right? This is about public perception and about something bigger than one individual lawmaker. But both parties, I think, are really wrestling with how do they do the right thing and how do they not have broader impact negatively against their own parties.
That's Susan Davis, congressional correspondent for NPR. Sue, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, today, British Prime Minister Theresa May struck a deal with European Union officials that moves Brexit talks on to the next phase. Under the agreement, there will not be a new hard border between the Republic of Ireland, a country in its own right, and Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK. The deal also means there won't be new rules imposed on UK citizens living in the EU or EU citizens living in the UK. And Britain reportedly could pay around $50 billion to the EU in a so-called divorce bill. NPR's Frank Langford is in London. Frank, tell us more.
Yeah, well, on the border, Robin, it ensures that people and goods will be able to move freely back and forth between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, as you point out, an independent country. But it's always been a really open border. I mean, for many, many years, a very open border, and there's lots of trade. And if you actually drive a car, you would see a bigger difference between Pennsylvania and New York. Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, it's so open, and people really like it that way. So that's not going to change. That's very important.
And of course, the Republic of Ireland, its own separate country, is going to be staying with the EU, and Northern Ireland will be Brexiting with the UK. So tell us more.
So the UK is going to meet its obligations to the European Union for the next few years as promised. It's going to be paying into pensions, things like this, all the things that it promised to pay into the budget for the EU so it doesn't blow a hole in the budget. And then, as you were just mentioning, the rights of their 3 million EU citizens living here in the UK, about a million Britons over in Europe, and they're going to be able to live, work, and study as they currently do. So this will not, you know, fundamentally change their lives.
Okay. And back to this really emotional issue of this, you know, hard border between the two Irelands. You know, talk more about why that was such a problem.
Well, you know what's amazing about it, Robin, is nobody thought about this.
Right.
This was never an issue when they had the Brexit vote about a year and a half ago. And what they found is that, not surprisingly, if the UK is going to leave, this creates a new land border with the European Union. And so the question was, well, what do? You now have an international border. Before, it hadn't really been because everybody was inside the EU. So there are questions of customs, smuggling, people moving back and forth. And the concern was, if they put up a hard border, you hurt trade, people will be frustrated. And also, if you remember, there was a lot of violence in the old days in Northern Ireland, and they didn't want the troubles to start off again, people not being able to get across the border and get frustrated. So what they've said now is there's not going to be a hard border between Northern Ireland and the island and the rest of the island of Ireland, but also that Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK will still remain completely open. And this is kind of an ambiguous agreement to make sure that everybody's happy. But how it actually works in the long run is very unclear. And I think we're going to see a lot of that as they get into further agreements. So to a certain extent, they kick the can down the road because this is so contentious. People are so concerned about the movement of people as well as the movement of goods.
Yeah. And talk about the money that the UK is going to be spending for this, as you say, divorce, because a huge part of the reason for the Brexit vote winning was that the people in the UK wanted more money to be directed to home. Now they're spending, what, $50 billion?
Exactly. And this is very – this is embarrassing. If you remember, the Brexiteers back in 2016 during the campaign were saying, oh, the UK is going to get $350 million back every week from the European Union. We're going to spend it on healthcare. It's going to be great. And now they have to tell people, oh, actually, we owe a lot of money. We're going to keep having to pay in for quite a long time. So this is embarrassing to the Brexiteers. And Theresa May today tried to put it the best face on it she could, saying it was fair to the British taxpayers and they would be able to have more money to spend here. But yes, it was an inevitable thing that they have to pay. And it was a little humiliating.
Right. But they did come up with a deal. So really, how would you score this for Theresa May?
She had to make a lot of concessions. She's a very weak prime minister. And I think one of the things that's becoming very clear to people in the United Kingdom is they are a junior partner in this deal. The EU is huge, but she survives to live another day, which is some is worth something. And the EU is really interesting today. They praised her, talked about her as a tough negotiator, said that she did a good job. And the reason is, I think, in part, they do not want her government to collapse. They certainly don't want to deal with another prime minister here. And the United Kingdom has been uncharacteristically unstable. And so the EU, you know, they do want this to work out. They're not happy. They're sad that the UK is leaving, but they don't want to see sort of political chaos here.
What's the takeaway from all of this?
It's really interesting, Rob. And I'll tell you, as an American living here in the United Kingdom, what I've noticed is there's a big, big lesson that when you have these relationships, these, you know, transatlantic, or the, in this case, it's a trans-European relationship, and you decide you're going to walk away from it, you pay a price. And you're seeing a little bit about this with Mr. Trump. He's pulling away from trade deals. He's pulling away from the transatlantic alliance, criticizing NATO. And if you look around the world, you know, the United States has considerably less influence than it did a year or so ago. And you hear this in China. You hear it in Brussels. And this is a similar situation here in the United Kingdom.
NPR's Frank Langfitt in London. Thank you.
Happy to do it, Robin.
Social media is abuzz in response to yesterday's sentencing of white former South Carolina police officer Michael Slager in the 2015 shooting death of the unarmed black man Walter Scott. You remember the cell phone video showing Slager chasing Scott down, shooting him in the back, planting his taser next to him. Well, he's been sentenced to 20 years in prison. What's been the response to that and other news of the week on social media? Danielle Belton, editor-in-chief of The Root, is here to tell us. Hi, Danielle.
Hey, Robin.
So in court, Slager expressed remorse. Walter Scott is no longer with his family, and I'm responsible for that, he says. He'd been tried in state court for murder in 2016. The jury deadlocked. He then pled guilty to violating Walter Scott's civil rights, but yesterday the judge said no, this was murder. What's been reaction?
Many online saw the sentencing as a rare moment of justice in one of the more notable police shooting cases involving an unarmed black man. Activist Brittany Packnett tweeted, "This is what accountability looks like. It shouldn't look like this happening less than 1% of the time, and still Walter Scott should be alive."
Yeah. Well, there was a tender moment in court where Walter Scott's mother was on the stand, and she said, "I forgive you. I pray for you. You will repent. Jesus come into your life. Just as you are, he will forgive you." And Slager nods and then mouthed the words, "I'm sorry." And she said, "I know. What grace." Any other online comments you want to share?
The ACLU also tweeted about how Michael Slager's conviction of Walter Scott is a rare example of police accountability. That tended to be the main theme where people pointed out how it's so rare for police officers to actually face justice when an unarmed individual is killed.
Well, there is that story. Also this week, on Wednesday, Time named the Silence Breakers, the women who've spoken out about experiencing sexual harassment or assault, their Person of the Year, collectively. But the Time cover that announced that choice is causing some controversy. Remind us.
Well, basically, there's two points of contention people have. One is the lack of Tarana Burke, the woman who actually founded the Me Too movement. It was not on the cover. Yeah. She is included in the article inside, but it's a very brief mention.
And let's remind people. This was over a decade ago, and she's an African American woman.
Yes, that is correct.
Right.
It was founded in 2006, by Ms. Burke. So you had activists like Raquel Willis tweeting, "Dear Black Publications, Tarana Burke deserves her own solo cover and feature for Me Too. It's up to us to elevate our own." The other point of contention was over Taylor Swift's inclusion in the story. Many online derided Swift as problematic due to the fact that she hasn't historically been vocal in her feminism. Others wondered why another pop singer, Kesha, wasn't included, considering her very public battle with her producer over accusations that he raped her.
Right. And Taylor Swift had a lawsuit with somebody who touched her inappropriately and went to court on that. And she did win. But the controversy over Tarana Burke, again, the woman who started all this 10 years ago, is that Alyssa Milano used it following the allegations against Harvey Weinstein. And people attributed it to her. But she's been very clear. She didn't start it. Yeah, she just took it.
Yes, she's been very open and honest about that and pointing out that Tarana Burke is the actual founder.
And what is Tarana Burke saying to all this? This anger? anger. There's been a lot of anger online that she didn't get the cover.
She's been very diplomatic about this. She's proud of the fact that the movement has really taken a foothold and that people are talking about it and speaking out in solidarity with other women who are victims of sexual harassment and sexual violence.
Yeah.
So she's really taken a point of grace about this.
Yeah, good for her. President Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel is hugely controversial still. But his speech announcing it is what's resonating on social media because he seemed to be slurring his words. People were wondering if his dentures were falling or worse. What are they saying?
Well, the term denture, hashtag denture Donald, actually trended on Twitter, thanks in part to Trevor Noah of The Daily Show. Noah remarked, it sounds like he just had a drink with Bill Cosby, later adding, there's no shame in having dentures, but there is shame in Donald Trump having dentures because he is vain. Could you imagine how he would feel if people started tweeting hashtag denture Donald?
Well, but people were worried that there was more serious health concern going on.
Yes.
And so yesterday, the spokesperson, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, said that the president will be getting a physical at Walter Reed in January, and it will be made public and everyone will know. So it was odd. She also said that it wasn't dentures, that he had just a dry throat. So there's that. Before we let you go, the bunny rabbit, we'll have
this
at herenow.org, this video of this man rescuing a wild bunny in the Ventura fires, I think it is, Ventura County Highway. First of all, you see these flames everywhere, and this man is running in and out of the flames to get this bunny. What are people saying?
People, the consensus was that this video will restore your faith in humanity. The fact that this individual risked his life to save a wild rabbit from the wildfires, it was really touching out of such a sad story where nearly 100,000 acres of land have gone up in flames in California.
And so many animals killed and at least perhaps one person. And we just urge you to look at it if you haven't seen it, because you also get to see he was driving on that highway. What they do, they're so used to wildfires there, they close it down to one lane, but you could still drive with flames.
Yes.
All around you, so you could see that. And I guess we should say, Jeremy had mentioned this as well, it is a wild bunny, so maybe he takes it to another place where the wild bunny can go.
I hope so.
The Week in Social Media with Danielle Belton, editor-in-chief of The Root. Danielle, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, from bunnies to dogs, humans have about 5 million scent receptors in their noses, dogs about 220 million, which makes them great tools for detecting everything from explosives to drugs. Dogs are also excellent at smelling out other animals and plants, which is why they are now being used to help manage conservation areas. At a nature preserve near Milwaukee, a dog has joined the staff to sniff out a couple of species. One it hopes to get rid of, the other it wants to protect. Susan Bentz from member station WUWM has the story.
One of those three little plants over there that's kind of sticking up individually.
Okay.
Kathy Hatch has been busy hiding several plants amidst tall grasses outside the Mequon Nature Preserve, about 20 miles northwest of Milwaukee.
The stuff, the bees, clover.
Oh, the clover.
So it's at the very edge of the clover, cut that way.
Hatch spends 2 days a week teaching Tilia, a year-old chocolate lab, the art of sniffing out specific scents. Hatch says the training leaves Tilia exhausted. So is Corey Gritzmacher with Mequon Nature Preserve. Hatch is also training him so he can work with Tilia as her handler.
There's many days I go home after training my brain hurts a little bit because it's not just trying to figure out the dog to go sniff out in the weeds and find a plant. There's definitely a science behind it, without a doubt. Let's set her up over here.
Tilia, wearing her official blue work vest, romps off onto the nature preserve grounds with Gritzmacher in tow. Hatch closely watches the team at work.
So he's going to pick any spot and just start her, and then he's going to watch the way her nose goes, the way her head turns, and he's going to follow the dog, moving in a way that supports the dog but doesn't help the dog.
What Tilia is being trained to find, but not touch, is an invasive species called wild parsnip. It's a nasty plant. Not only does it spread and crowd out native species, but its sap, if touched by animal or human, can cause serious burns. Tilia bounds off in a new direction and sniffs out one of the parsnip plants Hatch has hidden. This time, the dog responds exactly as she was trained.
They put their nose near it, and then they will stay in one place and look for the handler. See how she did that? Yep, so they're waiting for their cookie or their toy reward, but the handler has to check out, did you really get it? Is that what we're looking for? Oh, good job.
Dogs are good at finding invasive species because their sniffing power far surpasses mere humans' ability to see where the plants are popping up. Then people can remove them. Hatch says one day Corey Gritzmacher will be able to remove the leash and Tilia will stay on task, for instance, even if she sees a deer.
She will be so focused on her target odor that she will acknowledge there's a deer there, but not care because I'm working for either salamanders or wild parsnip.
Yes, Hatch said salamander. Mequon Nature Preserve wants salamanders to thrive here. Over the last few years, the preserve has been transferring two native species, blue-spotted and eastern tiger, from nearby healthy populations, hoping they will thrive on the preserve property. Handler Corey Gritzmacher says Tilia is learning to sniff out signs the salamander population are taking hold.
So this is where the dog's going to speed things up and expedite things for us and help us out.
Trainer Kathy Hatch says Tilia's sniffing potential is boundless.
If it has an odor, the dog can be trained on it.
After her 20-minute workout, Tilia heads back indoors to chill. Hatch calls that a valuable component of her training.
It's called latent learning. And so while she's resting, she's actually processing everything that went down out there.
Tilia will also enjoy time away from the job. She'll spend nights and weekends with the Nature Preserve's director and her family. Tilia may be Wisconsin's first on-staff conservation dog, but Pete Copolillo predicts she won't be the last. He heads Working Dogs for Conservation, a Montana-based organization.
I think they're out ahead of the curve. I think in 10 years' time, virtually every nature preserve, every federal agency, state land management agencies, they'll have their own dog teams because they're so cost-effective and they're so good at what they do.
And Copolillo adds, dogs are the perfect outreach tool. A friendly pooch sniffing out an invasive plant draws far more oohs and ahs than a human any day. For Here and Now, I'm Susan Bentz.
Today, the Labor Department said the U.S. economy added 228,000 jobs in November. The unemployment rate held steady at 4.1%. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. And Jill, this appears to have beat expectations yet again.
Yeah, just by a touch. I mean, we saw anything from about 150 to 250 in the estimates. I thought what was really good was that, you know, there was a lot of concern after those big hurricanes that we were going to see after effects for quite some time. This report may have been a touch better simply because of people coming back online in big markets like in Houston. But that said, revisions to the previous couple of months just amounted into a few thousand more jobs. We're back in this range of about 170 to 180,000 jobs a month. Year over year, the economy has added 2 million jobs.
Right.
That's amazing considering how long this recovery has been going on.
And we're seeing the unemployment rate continue to go down over the last many years. It's now at 4.1%. Is that full employment? Can it go much lower than that?
You know, according to the Federal Reserve, it is full employment. You know, what I think is interesting is that at 4.1%, we should be seeing signs of much tighter labor market conditions, which would translate into higher wages. But this 4.1%, it doesn't seem to be having the same power it once did. You know, we're at 17-year lows. And when we last saw this, we were sort of at the end of the dot-com boom. And there were employers adding jobs like nuts and paying people a lot of money. This report showed that wages were up, hourly wages, just by 2.5% from a year ago. And that's kind of meh, as the kids would say. We'd like to see that number get up to 3% year over year. So far, at 4.1%, you would think this is full employment, but the wage gains have not actually followed.
Of course, a lot of people are watching what's been happening in Washington and what might happen with this tax bill that has passed both the House and the Senate. When we're talking about unemployment at such a low level, what might that tax bill, which the president and Republicans have been promising is going to boost economic growth even further, what might that do?
You know, as I speak to a lot of very smart economists, what they say is there is likely to be a bit of an adrenaline shock, that there could be some spending by companies, capital expenditures, but it could also come in some bigger, broader wage increases over the next year. The idea that this is going to be long-lasting, that's what's really in dispute. It does not look like economic growth is going to be 3%, 3.5% for the next 5 years. It looks like we'll get a little spike up, and then we'll revert to the mean, which is about 2.5%.
Okay, I want to ask you one more thing real quick, Jill. Everybody's been watching Bitcoin. It has just been on a tear this week. It's dipped a little bit, but what do you think? Buy, sell? What are we supposed to do with Bitcoin?
You know, I love this story only because it is the ultimate frenzy. And we haven't had a frenzy in a long time. So going back 17 years, it sort of makes me feel like how I felt like when we were talking about Pets.com advertising at the Super Bowl in the year 2000. This little dot-com company that exploded. It went so much higher, was so fantastic, and actually had a product. With Bitcoin, it is as if you were going to go to Foxwoods, Atlantic City, or Las Vegas. You're going to put your bet down. You're going to either lose everything, make a little bit of money. You won't get a free drink from Bitcoin, but it is a wild ride. I'd be very careful. And don't forget, this Sunday, 5 p.m. Central Time, we have the first Bitcoin futures market in Chicago. The ticker is XBT.
Jill Schlesinger, a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks so much.
Take care.
There's been a lot of apologizing this week. In Washington, as more allegations of sexual misconduct surfaced, three members of Congress announced they'd be stepping down. But if you look back at history, the public apology has never been America's strong suit. We're joined now by Brian Ballow and Joanne Freeman. They are historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back.
Hi, Jeremy.
Thanks for having us.
Well, and as we often do with the two of you, let's go back to the early days of the United States and 1791, when the Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, commits adultery and later confesses. Tell us what happened.
Yes, well, indeed. So he does commit adultery in 1791. In 1797, he's accused of financial corruption, of misusing treasury funds. People find little scraps of paper in which he appears to be giving money to somebody. And he steps forward and says, no, 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 I am an honest public servant, but I was committing adultery and paying blackmail payments. And that's what those little slips of paper are. Yeah,
by
so
the way.
He writes a 95-page pamphlet with all kinds of proof and correspondence and the letters from the woman who he was sleeping with and everything else, Maria Reynolds, saying, look, really, I really, 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 really was committing adultery and was really, really not a corrupt public man. I was just a corrupt private man.
But how did the public react?
Well, I mean, it's not really swimmingly wonderful for his reputation. It's worth noting that in that 95-page pamphlet, there's one thing that he doesn't say. I'm sorry.
Hmm. And then what about Grover Cleveland? When he was running for president in 1884, he faced some incredible accusations in the papers. What came out about him?
He did. This is quite a scandal. So he's running for president in 1884 as the Democratic candidate, and the Republicans unearthed this story that 10 years earlier, he had had an illegitimate child with a woman named Maria Halpin, and the child had ended up being adopted, taken away from the mother and adopted, and this is exposed that he is the father of this illegitimate child. He steps forward and says, well, okay, I did have an illegitimate child, but let me explain the real circumstance. This is a loose woman who we're talking about, and she was sleeping with many of my friends, and I was the only unmarried one. So I stepped forward and claimed paternity, and then I helped her find a proper home for the child. So he's trying to make himself look good, but then, of course, the press goes out and investigates and finds Maria Halpin, and she says, that's not quite it. She says, actually, he was pursuing me. He wanted to date me, and I finally gave in, and at the end of the date, he raped me. Hmm. And then I had a child, and then he took the child away from me and tried to get me committed to an insane asylum to cover over his mistake, which is stunningly shocking behavior. But of course, what happens in the end, I mean, he's running for president, is some people believe him, some don't. It largely breaks down along party lines. And in the end, he's running against James Blaine from the state of Maine, who's accused of financial corruption. And the public, given a choice between financially corrupt Blaine or sexually corrupt Cleveland, votes for Cleveland.
Hmm. And Jeremy, just to underscore that partisan framework, the Republicans come up with the chant, Ma, Ma, where's my pa? And After Cleveland wins, the Democrats respond. They complete what has become a famous phrase, and that's gone to the White House. Ha, ha, ha.
The long history of election snark.
Yeah, why don't we have those little, limericks these days? We really, they should come back.
We have Twitter instead.
Well, let's get to the 20th century, Brian. And Congressman Wilbur Mills of Arkansas, he was caught driving with a stripper. What happened?
Well, the stripper jumped out of the car. And by the way, Jeremy, she was an exotic dancer, not a stripper. and the Capitol Police found her in the tidal pool and took her back to the car where they found an inebriated Wilbur Mills. Initially, Mills denied that he was even there, or his spokespeople denied it. Eventually, the Capitol Police said, look, he was there. He was bleeding. He was intoxicated. One thing led to another. And eventually, Wilbur Mills had to acknowledge that, in fact, he was caught with this woman in a very untoward situation. What really strikes me on our topic of apologies is how tepid his apology was. Mm. He did apologize to his constituents. He apologized to his wife. But then he said, and my poor wife was home with a foot injury, implying that if his wife had been there, this whole thing wouldn't have happened. Mm. If we look back, what looks good about Hamilton and all this stuff is at least he didn't try to shame his lover. But after Hamilton, we have a very long history, especially with Cleveland, but with Wilbur Mills, of basically blaming women of one sort or another. That's about as close as these men getting to apologies get.
Well, there's another important case that we have to talk about, one that many people know, and that is the case of Anita Hill and Justice Clarence Thomas. During his confirmation hearings in the early 90s, it came out that Thomas had allegedly harassed former aide Anita Hill, but he never apologized, did he?
He didn't come close to apologizing. He went on the attack, and he called any questioning on this topic a high-technology lynching. So far from apologizing, Clarence Thomas blamed the person who was accusing him. Anita Hill was questioned about the most intimate sexual things in her life, and she was questioned while her religious parents sat there in the audience. It was, at a minimum, incredibly humiliating and confirmed, again, a long line of blaming the women who came forward to be honest. And when people today ask, well, why didn't women come forward? I think we're giving a short history of what happens to women who come forward.
Except that I'm going to throw something in there. The fact of the matter is, I remember how searing that was, the Anita Hill testimony. And despite the fact that, of course, any woman would say, oh, heavens forbid I'm ever in that situation, she was such a powerful witness that it kind of made me feel not necessarily that I would do the same thing, but that there was a virtue in it that maybe I hadn't thought about before.
Well, Joanne, that's why I want to get to Senator Packwood.
Senator Bob Packwood of Oregon, who got into some trouble himself in the early 90s.
That's right. And Senator Packwood, a year after the Clarence Thomas hearings, started facing charges from staff members that he had used his position in order to force sex upon them. And in what might be seen as a precursor of many of the situations today, it wasn't just one woman who came forward. It was multiple women. Packwood responded just as we could have predicted. He said, hey, you know, I'm a progressive guy. I support women's issues. I would never do anything like this. And increasing numbers of women came forward. The Senate's Ethics Committee looked into it, and they subpoenaed and obtained Packwood's diary, where he bragged about, in essence, sexually assaulting dozens and dozens of women. The day of or the day after that diary was obtained, Packwood resigned. Although I should add, he went on to be a rather successful lobbyist after he resigned from the Senate. What does this have to do with Clarence Thomas? I think that coming a year after the Clarence Thomas hearing, there were a lot of women who watched what happened to Anita Hill, and they were much more motivated and encouraged, and it took a lot of courage to come forward.
It seems like the larger picture here, though, is that Americans, going all the way back to the beginning, don't really like to apologize for things.
Exactly, exactly. And I think there is an addendum here, Jeremy, on the question of apologies. Years after the Clarence Thomas hearings, Clarence Thomas's wife called Anita Hill, left a message on her machine, and asked Anita Hill to apologize for what she had done. So let's not say there's not a demand for apologies. It just is not always directed at the right people.
It's Brian Ballow and Joanne Freeman, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us, Jeremy.
This year has delivered lots of great TV, The Handmaid's Tale, the second season of Stranger Things. But in an age of peak TV, too much good stuff, NPR TV critic Eric Deggan says we are overlooking a lot. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So if it's so good, why aren't we seeing it? Why is it getting overlooked?
Well, I think you kind of alluded to it. There's just so much original content out there. I mean, the FX network counts all of this stuff and releases reports sometimes. And so they found that there were 455 original scripted shows in 2016. And the number could rise to 500 shows this year. And it makes sense that some really good shows might get kind of overlooked. And so I wanted to talk about a few of those.
Sure, and we are glad you are. So let's get to your first pick. This is Showtime's Wall Street drama, Billions. It stars Damian Lewis as the billionaire manager of a hedge fund. Here's a clip from season two.
The only currency that this firm has, that any firm has these days, is its winning streak. The Kevlar of knowing the answer. You break that, you break the whole thing. Nobody leaves here until you hand me an idea that I can shock the world with in a few days' time.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's intense.
But it
feels a little bit past, you know, all the Wall Street stuff. So why do you think we should be watching it?
Okay, so this is a show that first it had debuted new episodes real early in the year, so people don't remember it. But it's about this hedge fund guy who is being pursued by a U.S. attorney who's played by Paul Giamatti. And these two guys are trying to play King of the Mountain in New York City. Who's going to be on top? Basically, Paul Giamatti's character engineered this situation where he tempted the hedge fund guy into doing something illegal that he thought would cost the U.S. attorney and his family most of their family fortune, which it did. But to do that, the hedge fund guy had to do something illegal, and that allowed the U.S. attorney guy to prosecute him. And what the U.S. attorney's family didn't know is that he set all of this up and cost them their fortune just so he could get at this guy that he's been trying to catch for years.
And
they also have an actor who is, as far as I know, the first non-binary, non-gender-identifying actor who's also playing a non-binary, non-gender-identifying character, Asia Kate Dillon. It's just a really great series, and I think people overlook it, but it's a very textured and complex and great drama. I think people should check it out.
Let's move on to another show that you say is filling a void in late-night talk TV. It's Robin Thede, who's former head writer of The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore. She now has her own show on BET, The Rundown with Robin Thede. Let's take a listen.
You know what? The only thing that would make me happy is if Tamron Hall and Ann Curry came back to reclaim their airtime. Because look, TV executives, you know who's not out there groping people? Black women. There's just something in our DNA. I think it's called home training. And before you say, but Robin, Ann Curry's not black, I don't care what her ancestry report says, we claim her.
Okay. Why the show?
So, first of all, right now, I think Robin is the only black woman who's hosting a late night talk show on television. And in addition to being incredibly funny, she's incredibly black, meaning this show is filled with black culture. I mean, if people liked the way that Larry Wilmore presented the day's news and deconstructed it from the perspective of a person of color. She does it even more so on this BET show. And so I just want to spread the word that she's doing a great job. The show has gotten off to a great start. And people really should check it out, even though it's only one night a week. And maybe BET will expand the show and we can see her more nights in the week.
Okay, again, Robin Theed on BET. Then there's the family comedy Atypical, focusing on a teenager, Sam, who has autism, as he learns to relate better to his peers. Here's an example of how that sometimes goes for him.
Did you know there are 432 girls at our school, and 91 of them have a name that starts with an M, which is 21%, and the national average is only 9%.
100%? Don't care.
Okay, it's one of the more than two dozen new shows released on Netflix this year. Is that maybe why it got lost?
I think that might have been part of it. Some people may remember or know that I did a story about Atypical where I talked to some people who have autism, and they had some criticisms that the perspective of the show kind of found its humor in the autism of the lead character a little bit too much. And I could see that, and I would hope that when they do a second season that they have someone with autism on their writing staff to help them deal with that. But this is a wonderful family dramedy, and basically the teenager with autism decides that he wants to date and he wants to have sex. Mm. And so they have to talk about these issues in a realistic way. Atypical feels very realistic. You feel like this is a family that you know. And they do a good job of portraying someone who has autism, who doesn't let it hold him back, and really wants to try to be more independent than he has been in the past, and how that makes everyone in his family struggle a little bit more. So I really like the show. I think people should check it out. They should bear in mind some of the criticisms that people with autism have said about it. But other people with autism have said they love it, and I really enjoyed it. And so I'm hoping people will check it out.
Okay. NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And we'll have all the shows at hereandnow.org. And I am still trying to binge watch The Americans.
And The Crown is
and
back
today. And The Crown
today.
Is coming back. Oh, what will we do? Here Now is a production of WBUR and NPR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.